The Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will be in order. Today is Monday, February 28, 2011. We're going to skip the first item on the agenda, as I see no one here. So we're going to move right on to the next item, which is a presentation from the Office of Enterprise Technology. Carolyn Parnell, State Chief Information Officer. Carolyn, if you'd like to come forward, we'll start with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Carolyn Parnell. I'm the new commissioner for the Office of Enterprise Technology and the CIO for the state of Minnesota. I'm here to give you a high-level overview of the Office of Information Technology. I have brought a couple people with me if your questions get too deep for me, since I am relatively new. But this will give you a sort of big picture of what this organization is about and what we are accomplishing. This is not working. No. Excuse me, I'm trying to get the... Okay, just as a way of introduction, I have a number of years of experience in the public sector. I have worked as the Director of Networking and Telecommunications at the University of Minnesota. I have spent some time in the private sector. I worked for a software development company that wrote software for real estate agents and managed data centers and networks for multiple listing services around the country. I also work for Minnesota Public Radio as their Director of Information Technology and Broadcast Technology. And most recently, I was the Chief Operations Officer for IT for Minsku. I'm delighted to be here. I have learned that this is a very large and complex organization. I have yet to find something that is very strange to me or something that I haven't heard of. In the world of technology, you often see the sort of same issues that appear no matter what the organization is. Often it's a difference in volume or a little variance in what the actual technology offerings are, but most of them really so far have been very familiar to me. OET's mission is to provide the leadership and services that improve government. About 5 years ago, the Office of Enterprise Technology was actually brought into existence, and the Office of State CIO was created. In that time, I believe that the organization has done a good deal to line itself up for relevant services and technology. I think it's a little bit like turning a ship around. And when the organization was first put together, it was actually a centralization of existing technology organizations. And I think they've done a fine job of organizing themselves to best serve public agencies and the citizens of Minnesota. Does not mean that everything is completed, but they are definitely on their way and in many ways very innovative in what they've done. We have two broad responsibilities. The first is governance and oversight, and this stems directly back to the legislation that established the Office of Enterprise Technology. We are expected to provide leadership in terms of the overall direction of technology in the state. And that might be something as simple as working to define what the actual architecture, technology architecture, is going to be and how that decision is made. Governance and oversight also includes enterprise technology. And about 4 years ago, a very robust program in security was established by the Office of Enterprise Technology. It's an organization that I have found to be very functional, developing very nicely and a great service to public agencies and to the state of Minnesota. The third governance and oversight is just ensuring compliance and standards. For example, a couple years ago, the decision was made that there would be a standardization on hardware and software for all public agencies. This brought together a real ability to leverage procurement and contracts for volume. If we had those standards in place, the expectation is that everyone would use those standards, and that translates directly to savings for the state of Minnesota. On the other side of our responsibilities, our technology services that we provide. So, for example, we have a very robust and complicated series of networks around the state. When I was working for Minsku, we took advantage of this particular offering of OET, and all of our colleges and universities in the state are connected via this network. We also have a set of core services that we actually expect all agencies to use for purposes of security or standardization cost efficiencies. But we also have some services that go beyond those core services that we can also provide and encourage agencies to take advantage of those as appropriate. Just to give you a sense of the origin of our dollars, the bulk of our budget comes from our fee for services and a revenue account. There's a very active collaborative effort to review rates on at least an annual basis and to change them on an annual basis. We work closely with agencies, with the MMB, with CIOs from across the organization, so that we can make sure that what we offer is competitive, priced well, and of value to everyone who takes advantage of them. There is about $5.5 million of general funding that we use primarily for funding our security program and for some Office of the CIO activities, such as high-level planning for standards, architecture, et cetera. I think that's self-explanatory there. In terms of the services, the things that we provide basically are enterprise applications that includes email, collaborative tools, voice over IP, data center services, desktop network, professional, et cetera. It's a very well-established set of service offerings that are reviewed regularly, both for obsolescence and for additional services. The bulk of our services go to state agencies, but you'll see we also serve higher ed, counties, cities, government, quasi-government, such as municipalities, and K-12 public school. One of the things I've observed in the last 2 years, of history anyway, as things have been relayed to me, is that there has been a significant improvement in process offering and services for customers of OET. I think that has a lot to do with the alignment of the organization with service needs and with the demands of our customers and agencies. And there really is an impressive ongoing review of what we do and how we do it, a good deal of collaboration in making decisions about not only our spending but how we present and serve people that I think is very effective. I happen to be a person that's very reliant on governance systems. I believe that we as a public agency need to be very collaborative with our organizations. This is a very federated system. Each public agency has a commissioner and a CIO. Some of their IT organizations are very large and complex in and of themselves, and I consider their IT organizations and leadership as a sort of brain trust for OET to take advantage of. So I'm just in the process now of assessing OET and its governance structure in an effort to make sure that I fulfill my role as CIO. I am here to help the governor determine what direction technology should take in the state, what can we take further advantage of, and what reforms can we put in place using technology appropriately. This is not very easy to read, but I can tell you that it's a governance structure that I'm fairly familiar with. It's a sort of grassroots upwards, and the intent of this kind of governance structure is to have the technology experts within public organizations at the table as IT decisions are made. I think it's a mistake to think that OET can make decisions in a vacuum. I think we need to be as collaborative as we possibly can be. And from what I understand, at least on paper, this governance structure works quite well. I am in the process of, as you can imagine, a steep learning curve. I'm doing a lot of talking, a lot of listening. Some of that conversation is with the technology leadership within each public agency, which is in many cases the membership of these governance committees. So I'm in the process of determining how effective it is. On paper, it looks very good. Does it actually translate in the real world to what we expect it to be? So far, I don't have any reason to doubt that that's the case, but I am assessing it. So, again, in my sense of managing information technology, it's our responsibility to constantly look at how we are doing things. We can never sort of rest on our laurels. We not only have to constantly assess how we're doing things, we have to know what's coming down the pike. We have to be careful of technology that's in search of a market. And we have to have an overriding vision of what we actually are here for and who we are intending to serve, which to me in the end is the citizen of Minnesota. We were asked prior to coming to this meeting for some information on what we're doing in terms of innovation. And to me, you define innovation, at least from a beginning sense, as a different way of doing things, a movement towards more efficiency, and creative thinking in not only how things are done, but who does what. So I am finding that there has been a good deal of innovation in OET in the last several years. And you may be aware that there is a great deal of interest in consolidating the IT organizations from the public agencies under OET. I can tell you that this organization is no stranger to centralization. There has been some very innovative thinking around it, and I'll just briefly go through some of those issues. There are more slides related to this, but I won't go to them in detail. If you have questions, I can address them, but just kind of a high-level view of what this organization has done that I at least consider to be quite innovative. We are in the process of consolidating data centers. Right now, there are, I believe, more than 70 data centers in the various public agencies of the executive branch. A study was done a couple of years ago showing that many of those data centers, or in some cases data closets, were not up to snuff. They did not provide the adequate environment or security that was needed for the information that sat on the servers housed in those places. And there was a very collaborative effort with the public agencies to develop a plan for consolidating all of these data centers into an appropriate space that took into account the need for security and access, et cetera, for each application that sits in a public agency. As I said, it was a very collaborative effort. There is a steering team of CIOs from, I believe, some of the larger public agencies. An RFP has been distributed. We have that RFP back. Full evaluation of it has been on hold until I took office, and we're now in the process of determining what the outcome of that RFP is. But I do think it's an effort that will that is not designed to save money. It's more remedial than anything. It's something that should have been done quite a while ago. I do bring a set of fairly high standards about data centers to this position, and I absolutely think that this is the right move. I talked a little bit about this earlier, but there has been a great deal of progress in terms of security. One of the things you will hear me mention over time, likely, is that it's often difficult to measure the value of IT because sometimes its highest value is in its invisibility. So, for example, the fact that we have not had a security breach that has hit the front pages of the newspapers or the blogs or whatever is a signal that something is being done well and something is being done right. I believe that we have a very good security program in place, and there are increasing threats in the security world, as we all read about and hear about in the news, and we're no stranger to that. I believe that this particular program that we have in place and the organization around it is very well managed and absolutely essential going forward. In terms of purchasing, I mentioned earlier that there was a standardization process for hardware and software. Agencies have been very cooperative in that effort, and over the last 2 years, I believe we have saved the state of Minnesota more than $148 million. That's fairly significant. I think there are other savings to capture as we look at even more consolidation of procurement going forward. Another centralization project that was very successful was taking, sort of obsoleting all the various email packages and programs and management around state agencies and centralizing that into a Microsoft offering. That was completed over the last year. The next step is to add collaborative tools to that set of email tools, and then to move all of those servings into the cloud. And then last but not least, just a comment on the e-licensing project, which you may have heard of. It's, I believe, one of the first and largest efforts to move processes to a central location that will serve the citizens of Minnesota. So e-licensing at this point is a project owned by the Department of Labor and Industry, partnered with OET, I think it's about a 5-year project that really takes and simplifies the licensing process for professional and business licensees. So far, so good. So I think that this organization has done a lot of innovative planning and carried off a number of projects that have really shown that it is forward-looking. Do we have more to do? Absolutely. So we will continue to collaborate with the rest of the public agencies and beyond to see that we best serve the citizens of Minnesota and the public agencies as they also serve the citizens of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Parnell. Members, are there any questions? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions for you, and maybe since you're new, I don't expect you to know all the answers, but somebody else might want to answer this. The systems, first of all, the systems, whenever an agency is going to do a new systems project, my understanding is, and tell me if I'm wrong, that they're always supposed to go through your office to start that process. Any project of significant change. Is that correct or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, yes, that is the case, and I believe that is the intent of the legislation that established the agency. So public agencies are required to run by us their plans for projects, and we make sure that there's been a risk assessment, that there's proper project management, et cetera.
And, Mr. Chair, my understanding is, too, that a number of agencies haven't gone through this process and instead have gone out on their own and done some of their own contracting or whatever. But you can tell me if I'm wrong on that, too. And the other issue is with the problems with the Department of Human Services and the huge amount of money that's been spent on MMIS and their MAXIS systems. Were those projects, were they in coordination with your office, or were they done just through the Department of Human Services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I am going to have to get back to you and check on those. I had not heard of that as an issue. I'd actually also not heard that there are some agencies that are not complying with this requirement, but I will definitely check into that.
Okay, and then one more question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Finance, you said that e-licensing is through the Department of Labor and Industry, and then isn't there a big project with finance? Is that the SMART project or something we heard about in here recently that I'm not aware of, but another project to consolidate some of their budget and improve some of their budget reporting and things like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, you may be talking about the SWIFT project.
Oh, yes, that's fine.
And, yes, we are involved in that project. We do have oversight of that project, I've been asked to be on the executive steering committee of that project.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I just hope
Senator Goodwin.
I hope that you can look at some of those projects, huge projects that have been done in the past, and the tremendous waste of money with systems that don't talk to each other, particularly in the Department of Human Services, and some of the old COBOL language and stuff that they've used in some of these programs that's pretty much non-existent, and make sure that this project that's at the Department of Finance, the SWIFT project, doesn't turn out to be the same kind of nightmare as some of those other projects that I know we spent $1 billion or so on. So that's just my input from the years I tried to get information on those projects and how much were being spent and finding a lot of waste going on there and a lot of lack of knowledge about what was being done. So that's my input.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
Ms. Parnell, just because we transitioned here, I wanted to make sure that it looked like there were still some more slides, maybe 10 more slides. Did you want to go into those slides specifically, or had you already covered what you wanted to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, I do have those slides as a part of the record, but I don't think it's necessary to go into them in detail. If anyone has questions on them, that's fine. They sort of relate to the brief summary that I gave of how I believe OET is taking advantage of innovative ideas.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
I do have one question, if I may.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Parnell, you mentioned early on that you've got vast experiences. You mentioned the different organizations that you'd worked with, and you said your initial observations were things that you've seen that are very innovative in what they've done. Can you illustrate a couple of those items that you feel are very innovative as you've looked at these different agencies?
Ms. Parnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, I can give you an example in reference to the project I talked about in terms of centralizing email. I believe that we were the first state in the country to take advantage of some offerings from Microsoft, sign on with them, and really pull together all agencies in giving them a common email product. That project is in process. The next step is moving toward collaborative tools, and then actually we will move those into the cloud. That is innovative. In terms of comparing us with other states and looking at what even the federal government is doing these days. There's a great deal of interest in saving money and buying efficiencies through these routes, and we're actually in the process of doing that.
Ms. Parnell, do you know when that's going to come to the Senate?
Ms. Parnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, I'm not Oh, the email you mean, or the, I do not, my understanding is that OET does not provide services to the Senate, but I'm happy to have a conversation with whoever does.
Senator Daly?
I did have one other question, and that is on Thursday, we were both over in the House observing a very bipartisan bill that they were discussing about OET. Just like to get some of your observations on what they were discussing, what your thoughts are.
Ms. Parnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Daly, as I said last week in that meeting, I am pleased to be a voice at the table. This has to do with the centralization of IT from the public agencies under the umbrella of OET. I believe that it is something that is worthy of conversation. I have yet to see the fiscal note, so I do not know exactly what that would look like, what the financial impact is. I also understand and recognize that a vision and a plan is one thing, and operationalizing that and actually making something happen on a daily basis is something else. And I think I commented to the committee last week that we all know that the devil is in the details. So it's my intent to be a part of that conversation, to work to define an end state so that we can have a roadmap to that end state as we talk about and collaborate on this suggestion.
Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Parnell, just to follow up on Senator Goodwin's question, and maybe with the new administration it becomes a little bit irrelevant, but I had heard that in the establishment of the office there was some difficulty with some of the agencies understanding how they were to intersect with the new office and make sure that the technology was done on an integrated basis. Now, again, that might have been just the transition. If that were to happen hypothetically, I mean, how would you prevent it? How would the governor prevent it to make sure that what you're attempting to accomplish takes place?
Ms. Parnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, I presume that you're referring to the actual consolidation of services under the Office of Enterprise Technology. I do believe that it has to be a very collaborative process. I don't think that decisions can be made in a vacuum, and I think that, you know, these are not new issues. Things like, for example, one part of the proposal is centralizing help desks. That's in the world of technology, is hardly anything is age-old, but that's kind of an age-old issue, and IT organizations have been doing that for a long, long time. The difference in this particular centralization as opposed to some of the centralization projects I've been mentioning is already completed. The big factor here is that these have to do with people changes. For the most part, you know, changing, moving up to an email system is very different than shuffling people around. So I think that there needs to be a lot of consideration of that and a lot of collaboration in what that end state looks like and how we get there.
Senator DeLilly.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You mentioned that the agency has saved about $148 million over the last couple of years. Congratulations. That's very important work. What are some of the lessons learned, models implemented that you may be able to carry forward to some of your lesser customers? I see you work with the counties, cities, other groups. What are some things that they could be doing, either centralizing or modeling after what you have done to achieve some of those types of savings in their government entities?
Ms. Parnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lilly, I would answer that question by saying that I think that we could probably work with some of those smaller organizations to help them pool together volume so that even though there may be technology services or products that we may not use, they may use as a county or a municipality. And I think that our having learned how to best do that is probably something that we can have a conversation and coach them about. I also think that there are many more savings to be found in terms of some of these procurement questions. Some of that is a resource issue. I think that we can enter into conversations with them and sort of include them in the overall conversation as we continue to go down that path.
All right, Ms. Parnell, when the MMB website gets up, it seems every time an agency lately wants to get some reports for this committee, I get a report back that it's crashed again. I would look forward to the report on the employees and the compensation to be forwarded.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Senator Wigert.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. on one question. Federal government collects a lot of data in Minnesota. There's some interfacing, I assume, in addition to what you're doing with all the other groups. There's 70 data centers that you mentioned, but then with federal government, it's got to be mind-boggling. So could you just tell us a little bit more about any interfacing that goes there and challenges that we might be aware of?
Ms. Parnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wigert, I think that I am too new to the position to really have a clear picture of that. I do have some familiarity with some of those efforts on a national and a federal basis. But so far, it's been my observation that there's a very siloed approach to data. There are multiple databases. There are some efforts and some plans to move forward to consolidate some core information that can be used going forward. But I think at this point, I just don't know enough about all those particular efforts at this point in time.
Mr.
Senator Wigert.
One brief follow-up question on the Technology Advisory Board, private sector representation, and how often does the group meet? Just a little more about that.
Ms. Parnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wigert, you're referring to the Commission on Service Innovation?
Senator Wigert.
Mr. Chair, thank you. At page 13 on your handouts, you have a chart, and it shows the Commissioner's Technology Advisory Board.
Yes.
What I'm referring
yes,
to.
We do have partnerships with a number of companies and organizations that we do meet with regularly. We also, I thought you were referring to the Commission on Service Innovation, which has a broad representation of not only external companies, but also municipalities and organizations related to other sizes of government.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Parnell, for that Technology Advisory Board, is there generally consensus, as far as you're aware, on the recommendations that are developed for the state CIO?
Ms. Parnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wigert, to my knowledge, decisions are not brought forward unless there is a consensus and that there's a fair amount of effort that goes toward finding that consensus, or at least majority.
Senator Goodwin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parnell, there's one more thing I'd like to say, and that's we have had problems in the past of RFPs for IT contracts being sometimes written by the person we expect to get the contract, which I hope doesn't happen anymore. And the other is to have the RFP not be detailed enough and then have the contract not be detailed enough so that there's a whole bunch of change orders that end up costing a whole lot more so that other bidders maybe could have bid on the contract and gotten it, but we take a different bid and then we get a number of change orders, and that's added tremendously to the cost of contracting for IT services and a number of other services. So I would just ask you to really, really watch that and make sure the language in contracts is specific enough and that the RFPs are detailed enough and that they're not written by the vendors.
Thank you, Ms. Parnell. We're going to jump back to our first item on the agenda, a presentation from the Black Minnesotans Council. Lester Collins, the executive director, is here today.
Good
please state your name and you can proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Lester Collins, and I am the Executive Director of the State of Minnesota Council on Black Minnesotans. And I proudly will say I have been for about 22 years now. So I've seen a number of new faces in my time here. And one of the things I do want to say is that even before I really officially began, I have some of the other directors here, Eileen Herr, Hector Garcia, and others, and I first want to say to you, I try to work as close as we can together. I think most of you are more than aware that there are four so-called ethnic councils, and the important thing is that while we have very different concerns, just as each of you in terms of the districts you represent, we also have very common concerns, and we do strategically meet on an ongoing basis at trying to do our work as collectively as we possibly can. One of the things I was asked to speak to today is the mission of the council, and you all will recall, even from your meeting on Friday, of which I was a part of but didn't present, is that we are essentially here to advise the governor and you on issues affecting our constituency. In the case of the Council on Black Minnesotans, that constituency primarily would be referred to as the Native African population, those from Africa more directly, and African Americans in the state. And I guess I could probably break that down even further, but those two distinct populations are the individuals that we attempt to represent. And if you will, be a voice for and to create, I guess, an atmosphere or at least a condition, a comfort level, if you will, in these great halls where they feel indeed that they are a part, that they do have a voice. And while many decisions, many of them, impact their lives, I would say that our ethnic populations, for the most part, have not been as involved or as comfortable, I guess, in this place of decision-making as I would like for them to be. So I see as my mission, along with the other councils, that of educating our constituency in terms of the decision-making and responsibility that you all have, but equally what their role is and the part that they can play. I am pleased to say that, number one, we are a nonpartisan organization. And in that instance, I think I've had the pleasure of working, with all of our representation. I mean, whether it was Republican, Democrat, or et cetera. And I think that's even more pressing in this day and time in terms of representing my constituent population's concerns. We are a 13-member board, as you probably can see. I've been around long enough to where we started off with seven constituent representatives. There was also one point at which there wasn't necessarily African representation on our board. Several years ago, with your help, we were able to make sure at least two of those individuals, East and West African individuals, were represented on our board. I'm also pleased to say that not only do we represent that constituent population, but two of our chairs, one from Nigeria, and a gentleman that I was in company with both yesterday and on Saturday, his name is Tyretta, is from Ethiopia, and he also was the chair of our board. I guess leaving that alone, essentially the whole idea is to try to bring the concerns, the impact of the decisions that you all make on a daily basis as it relates to our constituent populations, to make them aware of those concerns, but also let them know that they can play a part in those decisions, its impact. And one of the ways that we try to do that is to do that through the many commissions and other bodies that exist outside of the legislature itself. In fact, I've found over a period of time some of our best board members are those that work on what I would call other constituency groups, and I'm talking about crime and justice, poverty-related areas, and other areas within the state. I think it's one of the best training grounds, if you will, in terms of those voices, and I mean areas like mental health, mental illness, other health constituency-related concerns. And so we are also interested in not only individuals representing or serving on the Council on Black Minnesotans, but serving on the many commissions, which many of you are aware of, in terms of their voices being heard. In terms of one of the other areas, I think, was agency improvement to Minnesota. I personally believe and have seen that a constituency that is aware not only of their responsibility, but also their the impact that they can have on state government. I think that we have many brilliant scientists, doctors, and many others within our population group. One of the concerns that I have, and we've addressed them within our constituency population, and I'm talking about all the councils, are many individuals that are coming here from other places. And in this case, I'm not talking about as immigrants or at least as it relates to the challenges in that area. I'm talking about the talents and gifts that these individuals have. And I'm talking about in terms of science, mathematics, and you know, medical areas, all those kinds of things, and the licensing kinds of procedures, or you might say challenges that they face here. I think we've made tremendous progress along those areas. I think even along the area of alternative teacher licensure, which you all, I think, are helping to help us make some strides in terms of the utilization of individuals within our community, in terms of the achievement gap and other areas that have been spoken of. So, again, not only essentially what government, you know, can and will offer to our constituents, but I think more importantly, the many talents, contributions, innovations, et cetera, that can be brought here. If I had had time or had thought, I'm sure that I would more than amaze you all, but I am going to take just a second, if you will. This happens to be the end of what we call Black History Month. And I've started to bring some stuff. In fact, I think I still will forward it in your packets in terms of contributions that African Americans or Black individuals within this country, let alone within this state, have made to Minnesota and to this country. There's a story, one of them, about a young man coming to his mother and kind of asking her, essentially, what would the world be like without Black people in it? And very briefly, she kind of runs through a whole scenario of situations. A few of them would be the comb that I'm sure most of you used this morning, and the brush were indeed invented by Black individuals. The refrigerator that you use, the stoplight that we happen to, you know, stop coming here. I think I already mentioned refrigerator. In the medical area, believe it or not, blood transfusions by Charles Drew. And by I think we made a lot of improvement. Charles Drew also happened to die by the fact he was not able to get a blood transfusion because of his color. But he was responsible when many of our soldiers early on lives were saved because of his innovations. I could go on in terms of the contributions that essentially Black folks have made to this country, and let alone to Minnesota. Speaking of that, that kind of brings me to the area. I think one of the things you wanted me to speak to had to do with the humanities dollars, the cultural arts legacy funds. As I view them as a part of all of the council's charges, it talks about publishing the accomplishments, essentially, of Minnesotans, kind of related to each one of our constituent populations. As I view the humanities dollars that have been afforded each of the councils, one of the things that we're attempting to do is to highlight those very contributions. One of them, and that you have been spoken to and talked to about, are what we call, and I won't spend a lot of time, absent narratives. Essentially, it means the presence of individuals who look like myself and the contributions that they have made, and what little essentially is made known of them, not only in terms of our adult population, but also in terms of our students. And I don't necessarily mean students who you know, are Black or African. I'm talking about students, period. And too often, that history, again, as you have often heard, is not included in our textbooks, in our history books, you know, for these kids. And I think it's important as we sit at tables and decision-making places like this, and particularly, I guess, if I were to mention it, even the construction of this building. And by the way, I'm not sure that many of you even know that the Capitol in Washington, D.C. was also designed, you know, by a black individual also, let alone the construction, you know, of it. A young woman, well, it used to be a young woman. Her name is Jean Cooper. She's about 80-something years old. Her father played a very key role in terms of the construction of this particular building that we sit in today. Back to the humanities funds, essentially the arts and cultural impact of our communities, the kind of contributions that I think in this day and time, although we have a tendency to look at those hard numbers and those kinds of things, I think it's equally interesting or important that the artistic contributions of African and African Americans be included in the history of Minnesota. One of the things that we have contributed a large portion of the dollars that we received is the establishment, unfortunately, of what would be the first and only African American museum, which is located in South Minneapolis. So we did make a contribution to a proposal that they submitted to us, the largest of which we've made at this particular point, for $50,000 to that establishment, so that the legacy, history, contributions, if you will, of black Minnesotans are essentially recorded, along with the very valuable and important history of all of us in the state of Minnesota. One thing I should have said backing up, by the way, my apologies for not having been here initially. We are on our way as a council to Rochester, Minnesota, to a community forum, which was scheduled today. I thought that I was going to be speaking on Friday, and I certainly appreciate your accommodation in terms of taking me today. But in the process of trying to get the vehicle, a van, for the board, which took longer than I thought and wasn't there when I first got there, it kind of held me up by a couple of minutes. My apologies to you. I'm going to, if I could, maybe end, you know, with at least what I've shared with you so far, and just kind of open it up for questions to you. So, if I could.
Do we have any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wager.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Collins, one of the key roles of the council is advising the policymakers on key issues.
Yes.
And perhaps we could get an update on any recommendations you have, not now unless you want to elaborate, but on closing the achievement gap and increasing the graduation rate. Your five of us on this committee are also members of the Education Committee, ably chaired by Senator Olson. And that's a very, very important issue, as I know you
number
share.
One.
And and but the specific recommendations that you have on that, and being as specific as possible, where there are best practices that have been documented that have led to increased results, and because we need to capture that and spread that to really make progress, because unfortunately, we aren't making progress.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think what I would like to do is to forward you specific concerns that we do have. I will say that we, and it was mentioned on Friday, have worked fairly closely with Senator Patricia Torres, specifically in that area. We serve on a number of other committees. There is also a conference being held tomorrow night that I would like to bring, you know, as I leave here, I'll ask my secretary to forward to dealing specifically with the black male, which is even a greater challenge in terms of that achievement gap. We've held about three forums around the state specific to the area. We did other joint collaborations, I think, with the other councils in that particular regard. Another organization that we work with that you're familiar with is the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, which the council was key in terms of creation of. But I would like to, rather than try to do that specifically, and more importantly, because my consultation and advice have come from folks who live, breathe, and know this area, and I think the recommendations that I'll forward to you will be reflective of that. But I would agree with you that we seriously have to do something, you know, in that area, in terms of best practices, et cetera. I serve on a couple of different groups. One is called the African American Leadership Council, which has an education arm, and I'll forward those concerns as it relates to parental involvement and other concerns. And another group is called the African American Leadership Forum, which is well-tooled, you know, and the committee I serve on is the Education Committee, so I will forward as many of those concerns to you as we possibly can as we look forward to working forward with you. So,
thank you. And probably through the chair, and the yes. chair will distribute that.
I'll make certain I do that, sir.
Thank you. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry that we have to have this conversation about education in your committee.
Mm-hmm.
But as you, as Senator Wigger stated, there's many of us in that committee, and you share our passion as well. I just want to remind Senator Wigger and Senator Olson, who were here, clearly after I was elected, that was the first step I took, which was to invite the councils mm-hmm. at the local level, councils at the national level, National Council on State Legislators, Roy Wilkins Center, Dr. Myers, who's done extensive analysis of disparities in labor, housing, and education. And I work on it for two consecutive years to draft a bill that moved with bipartisan support in the House and the Senate, had the support of 75 districts throughout the state of Minnesota to deal with achievement gap with very specific recommendations. It was vetoed by the governor. I would very much love to have the opportunity to reintroduce that bill, Senator Olson, and review those. I didn't come up with those recommendations. The communities did, and we spent 2 years of extensive work and analysis, of pure policy analysis, and reviewing models throughout the nation. So I wanted to let you know, and especially for fresh members that are interested in this area, that those documents exist. And they were documented and researched during 2 years by a large number of people in the community.
Could have been a part of a bigger package. Thank you very much, Mr. Collins, for coming in before the committee.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're going to move to our last item on the agenda, the presentation from Explore Minnesota Tourism. Mr. John Edmond, Director. Please state your name and proceed.
I'm John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be back before you to talk a little bit about Explore Minnesota Tourism, and specifically to answer any questions you have regarding the governor's budget proposal. I think you have most of this information in front of you, and I'll go through it rather quickly. And as always, Mr. Chairman, members, if you have any questions, feel free to stop me. But I'm just going to give you kind of a brief. You've already had the agency overview, but give you just a little grounding as to who we are, our current budget, and mostly talk about the governor's proposed budget, the film TV board budget proposal, and I know you had some questions regarding the car rental tax proposal, and I'll talk about that as well. Just to reground us, our goals are very simply to encourage leisure and hospitality sales tax, employment, and increase the number of travelers in Minnesota. This is just a brief chart that I wasn't able to show you the last time, showing the growth in sales and receipts from the tourism industry. We're about an $11 billion industry right now. That's only those direct leisure and hospitality businesses. This shows you the growth of sales tax revenue, which I think is real important for all of us, how we can grow additional revenues for Minnesota, and the growth of leisure and hospitality employment. We're at about a $250,000 industry. I skipped over this last time, as my staff pointed out, but I just did want to mention that we have a 28-person council. It's a private sector council that helps guide and advise us on our efforts. And it's a council made up of tourism organizations, businesses, legislators, four legislators, two from each body, as well as various statewide representation. Now, our current budget in this current fiscal year, we're about $8.3 million operating budget. In addition to that, there's a $500,000 public-private incentive component. We have to generate money from the private sector in order to earn this incentive from the public sector. Basically, for every $3 that we generate, we bring in another dollar from the general fund. Also included in our budget is $325,000 from the Film and TV Board. Last year, there was a $1.2 million snowbait. Actually, this was in fiscal year 10 for reimbursement of film and TV productions in Minnesota. We also, in addition to that, do generate public and private partnerships because that's the right thing to do to try to leverage our resources. We brought in about $6 million last year, about $4 million in kind, $2 million in cash. And this just gives you a quick overview as to where our money is spent. Most of it's spent in marketing and communications, as well as technology in a variety of other areas, including grants, fulfillment, and industry relations. And the film board portion that I mentioned is $325,000 operated. Their match is a little different than ours. It's $1 general fund match for every private sector match for every $3 from the state, and then they received that $1.2 million snowbait last year. So that's kind of just to give you a bit of a grounding as to where we have been. The governor's proposed budget for fiscal year 12 and 13 recommends an $8.091 million annual operating budget. Also included that in that budget is the $500,000 public-private incentive funding. Further, there's a $1 million just for fiscal year 12 only provision for the Film and TV Board jobs program. That's the snowbait program that's used as an incentive to bring in new film to Minnesota. And there's also $325,000 annual appropriation for the Film and TV Board for a total of $9.9 million in fiscal year 12. The proposed operating budget reduction and reflected in our budget includes $260,000 reduction in each fiscal year of the tourism budget, and those are primarily for salary and benefit savings through early retirement, people taking advantage of that. Now keep in mind, I didn't mention it here, but we're a relatively small agency. I believe we're about 45 FTEs, 60 employees, but the FTE is about 45. Other retirements and vacancies, about 2.0 FTEs would be included in this reduction. And we've really tried over the last several years to decrease the number of people that we have on staff by figuring out different ways to do things, to reallocate work, to reassign and reorganize to use the resources that we have most effectively. So these are not big numbers, but in the scheme of things, as a small agency, they still are significant. And there'll be additional savings through professional contract and other IT savings. The governor had indicated to us that he would like to maintain our high-priority programs, and those are those programs that really bring in the sales for the state of Minnesota, those things that bring in the best return on investment. He also would like us to continue to leverage public and private sector partnerships and programs that bring revenue and jobs to Minnesota. The Film and TV Board recommendation is pretty much the same, $325,000 for operations for each year, $1 million for the snowbait program, which is used to attract film. About 15 to 20% of eligible expenditures are reimbursed through this snowbait program. Now, this is the one big difference in our budget recommendation for this year versus the last biennium is the recommendation of a 1% increase in car rental tax dedicated to tourism. This tax would generate about $2.6 million or more, about $3 million in the next fiscal year, specifically to travelers to Minnesota. One of the big differences about this is that it specifically would be designed to increase revenues of not only the car tax rental companies, but also tourism businesses all throughout the state. The majority of these revenues, about 62%, would be captured from the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Most of those businesses, most of those collections are travelers or business travelers, and most of all the additional other collections are within the metro area. And the reason that this is in here is because we're being outspent by our competitors. And I know there's a lot of people here, Mr. Chairman, that have come here and said, you know, we need more money, we're getting outspent by others. But we rank, just to put it in perspective, 28th in the country in terms of total U.S. tourism spending. We're outspent by our competitors in Michigan, Missouri, South Dakota, Even Wisconsin Dells spends more money than we do. So we need to diversify and find out different ways that we can remain competitors. And the idea of a car rental tax was something that was recommended by our advisory council, our tourism council of private industry folks all throughout Minnesota, that looked at different ways that other states are funding their efforts, whether they be statewide lodging taxes, fees, restaurant taxes. And this was probably the one that has definitely was the one idea that had the most industry support. The cost itself would be minimal. It's about $1 for a $100 two-day rental. In terms of how we would compare, we're about 24th right now in terms of car rental tax among airports. And even with this tax, car rental tax would be on par with other states. So this would allow Minnesota to compete and to diversify our funding.
Mr. Edmund, before we go any farther, I just want to know if there's anyone in the audience that has any testimony specifically on the car rental tax increase or anything here. I just saw some folks here. All right, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that issue, do you have information on what percentage or what portion of the car rental taxes generated by tourists versus in-state? Because I've met with people over the years that always comes up because it seems to be a tax that you get somebody else to pay for, and that seems to be the popular way to go in taxes. Much of the car rental is done by agency car dealers and repair shops to provide loaners for their customers. And I'm not so sure that may not even actually outnumber what is being used in tourism. I don't know the data, but I would be interested, and I wondered if you'd done any research on that, because that is I think counter to the assumption that if that's the case, of that just taxing people that come here.
Mr. Edmund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have done some preliminary research with the Department of Revenue, and what we found is that 62% of all the car rental tax generated in Minnesota is from the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. I think it's a safe assumption to say that most of the people that go into the airport are either business travelers or leisure travelers. The majority of the remaining 37%, we don't have any definitive figures of how many people those are actually that are using it for a loaner car, how many of them are using it for a larger car on a trip, a limo, things like that. But we're a little different than other states with the major metropolitan airport here in that we do know that the majority is used for the majority of the taxes that are collected is by travelers. The other thing that I guess I would point out too, and I've looked at some of the concerns from the car rental companies in other states, and basically some of their comments were that this oftentimes a tax like this is attached to a car rental tax because they're looking for different ways to fund other projects. This would be a tax that would specifically be used to generate increased travel to the state of Minnesota. So it, in fact, could aid and help, not exclusively, mind you, but it could aid the car rental companies versus, some tax that was tied to this would be used for some unrelated purpose.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sir, how do we compare in the size of our tax now to other states, comparable states, or where do we rank in terms of the size of our car rental tax?
We're about 24th in the country in terms of the major metropolitan airports. We're about in the middle right now in terms of our ranking. I'd have to look at and I have some of the statistics here, and so does my staff. We can get you more specifically about that breakdown of car rental tax. I think it's a 6.2% car rental tax, and you have the state sales tax, you have legacy tax, you have a lot of other things that are added on to it, depending on the municipality and the purpose. But if you add them all together, we're about in the middle of the rankings with our competitors in other states.
Thank you.
I'm glad, Senator Olson, you brought that up, because I have a report from the National Business Travel Association, the NBTA, makes a comment that research has shown that more than half of car rental customers are generally local And most companies spend at least half of their car rental budgets in the markets where the companies are located. And I'm just, and I understand the 62%, but coming from the marketing world, I'm just trying to envision your marketing strategy. Come visit our lakes and fish and snowmobile, and oh, by the way, we're going to zap you a tax on the car you're going to rent because you're flying in. I mean, it's concerning that we have to look at that at this point in time. I think you're doing, by the way, we've talked, I think you're doing a fabulous job with the amount of dollars that you have, but I think this state, of all states, probably has a better marketing position with our 10,000-plus lakes and the four wonderful seasons that we share, even though winter seems to be longer this year than normal. I think we have a telling story about how we live in this great state, and unfortunately, a tax like that, I think, hinders it a little bit. Any other questions?
Just, Mr. Chair, just to complete the few last slides that I have, why do we do this? It's the return on investment that we bring for the state of Minnesota. For every dollar that we invest in marketing, we bring back $4.66 back in state taxes, $20 in wages, $53 in gross sales. Tourism and growth, it provides revenue for Minnesota and jobs. And Mr. Chair, I certainly understand your viewpoint. It wouldn't be our first choice necessarily to impose an additional tax in order to generate funds to grow tourism. But we're in a position right now, as all of you are, even despite the forecast this morning, we have very limited general fund dollars, and we need to start looking at alternatives, whether they public-private partnerships, alternative fundings, if we are going to be competing with our other states. And this is one way for us to do it. I really believe that we need to continue those partnerships and that we can be competitive. So our goal basically is to get a $20 billion industry by the year 2020, which would mean 271,500 jobs, $1 billion in additional state sales tax. And while this may not be perfect, this new budget does allow us to grow revenues and jobs, diversify funding, stay competitive with other states, and develop new partnerships and to enhance recovery through tourism. So that's about all for my prepared remarks. Thank you, Mr.
You know,
Chairman.
One thing, not that it's going to make a difference one way or the other to this committee when we're taking a look at the general fund dollars that obviously we oversee, but can you give us an idea of the legacy dollars that you receive and the impact that that's had on what you're using them for? Maybe just a short little background on that.
Yes, I'd be happy to, and I'm sure I could just envision my assistant director who's been behind me, who's been very involved with the legacy program. We have not received any legacy dollars at all, and in fact, when that amendment was first going through the legislature, we talked about it as an alternative way to fund tourism, but I think a lot of the feedback was that those funds need to be dedicated to the environment, to the arts, and we didn't need to dilute it, so we stayed out of that. Our position right now is we need to connect visitors with the resources of the states. I mean, that's why we're making this investment, so we can bring people to communities and the parks and the trails, no matter if it's a state park, a local park, et cetera. But the way the structure right now is, it's a little bit difficult for us right now to access those dollars because of all of the different the different systems that are already in place. And we're a part of that. My staff, Colleen, has been very involved. And Colleen, I don't know if you have any comments. I don't want to throw you on the spot here. But she's been very involved in that. And we're really trying to find a way to access those dollars. But I'll tell you, Mr. Chair, it hasn't been easy. But we don't receive any dollars right now.
All right. Senator Wigger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erdman, two questions. First, I think I know part of the answer, but what are the top four destinations in Minnesota by visitors?
Mr. Edmund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's always the question that the media tries to ask me, too, and I try to talk about the entire state no matter where you're located. But I think what really I talk about the regions of the state and the diversity of what we have in the state, whether it is the metro areas, obviously the Mall of America, the culture, the heritage, the history, the sports, those types of things. It's the lakes in northern Minnesota. It's the rural, the small towns in southern Minnesota. It's that unique quality of life, the natural resources, really what attracts people. I couldn't give you a list. I could actually in terms of attendance, but it's really the diversity that's unique about our state.
Well, Mr. Chair, I thought it might help analyzing return on investment where it's going, but I understand where you're coming from on the answer. Could you comment further on the untapped, unrealized potential for growth in Minnesota for tourism, Minnesota residents, and then outside Minnesota and where that market is? Is it adjacent states or beyond or national? So each of those markets and what we're going to do to penetrate in each for growth.
Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think the untapped potential is in the surrounding states. We do pretty well in keeping Minnesotans traveling in Minnesota, particularly right now where people are looking for things closer to home. If you look at greater Minnesota, whether it's northern Minnesota, southern Minnesota, Minneapolis-St. Paul is the market, and that's great. We don't want people leaving the state. We want to keep those tax dollars here. But the biggest potential is bringing in new tax dollars to Minnesota from surrounding states. And given our budget, when you look at budgets like Michigan, that has a $42 million budget that does national TV advertising, in Missouri that has $16 million, in Wisconsin with all of their challenges, about $15 million. We are not able to reach beyond the north central states. Chicago, as in a market, is there some nearby markets with incredible potential that we're not even able to reach because it's very expensive to market to Chicago. There are some destinations in the southern United States would be great to market to, say, as Texas, to try to get people up here when it's really hot there to get them up here. And internationally, we've really focused on markets like, well, I consider Canada almost a domestic market, but Canada and Mexico, but overseas, Japan, Germany, the UK, Scandinavian countries, but there's real potential in China and India as well, and we haven't been able to penetrate those as well. So those are some of the things on our target list. If we had the additional dollars, those are some of the areas we'd go.
Senator Wicker.
Yes, thank you. And Mr. Chair, finally, Mr. Epton, the internet, social media, are you at the top of your potential there?
Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think I saw over the weekend the social network, and I think I heard a comment about websites. They're never done, and so we will never be done and on the top of our game. But that's an area where we are continuing to grow. We're right now putting 50 to 60% of our media budget into internet marketing. Now, people thought that brochures would go away at this point in time, but they have not. People still want to get a brochure. They want to look at it and discuss it with their family and friends. So that's still a part of it. But in terms of where we could be, we've just rebuilt exploreminnesota.com. We've just rebuilt our website. We're trying to create a website that allows the industry to take the data on our website and put it on their website. So that if you're a resort and you want to know the events going on in Brainerd, you could figure out those events. You could put it 10, 20 miles around there. So it's not as much people going to our site as it is going to other site and getting that being a part of that conversation all over. In the terms of the social media there, we've really increased our presence on, you know, the Facebook and the Twitters and the things like that. We're also in the process of developing an enhanced mobile application as well as an app. So that's an area, again, we try to do as much as we can. We're generating probably about $200,000 to $300,000 a year, depending on exactly what point in the year you are, in terms of advertising revenue that we reinvest in that. But it's a project that is never done.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.